discussing national and international issues. You're listening to Pella Neuroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome to the Pella Neuroth-Taylor Show on this Monday afternoon. It's International Dance Day, whatever that means, Google it. Our first guest, Eric Krauss, is a returning guest. He's a Frenchman who, a former Muscovite resident, a financier, who's rubbed shoulders with a lot of top people in Russia and knows what they really stand for during the swinging 90s and noughties, when quick, get-rich-quick schemers dominated Moscow and it was a city of gangster violence. The WSJ, the Wall Street Journal, has told the truth now about Navalny's death. He was said to be an assassination by Putin, but the Wall Street Journal, citing Western sources, CIA, says no, it wasn't. Our second guest, Ryan Christian, is going to tell us about the surveillance that's really going on the border in a way that we're going to introduce these kind of smart borders, smart walls, and Trump is in on it, but is it really good for our privacy, and is it all about control? And should the Republicans really be going for this kind of border, even as they want to close off illegal immigration? After the hour, we've got Michael Waller, who's a friend and returning guest, who's going to tell us about the infiltration of the deep state into cherished liberal institutions. Catherine Mayer's a long history of getting engaged in color revolutions and propaganda, and now she's heading National Public Radio, and she was formerly head of the Wikimedia Foundation, which also is the reason why it's an unreliable source of information about the CIA and various other deep state activities. It used to be said that there was no color revolution in Washington because there was no American embassy in Washington. But of course, we'll look at the coup of 2020, the apparently stolen election, and the J6 events. And you could ask whether that was not a color revolution and whether we'll have one in 2024. That could be down to propagandists like Catherine Mayer. Our final guest is Alex Newman, who's an award-winning international journalist, educator, and author and consultant. He focuses on the increasing digital control over our lives that's taking place on a national level, but also apparently on an international level. And he thinks the locus of control there is the United Nations, where many things unfavorable to our freedom will be decided at a summit for the future in 4 months' time. So he'll tell us a little bit about that. Before we go into the news, which I don't doubt will include events in Israel and Ukraine, I want to talk a little bit about a social issue. This is the Social Issues Department. I just saw that Rishi Sunak has denied or refused to introduce the possibility of introducing smacking as a punishment, refused to ban smacking, which is legal in the UK, in England, but banned in Scotland, and I think Wales, and in many other countries. And as Sweden was the first country in the world to ban smacking in 1979, I thought I would tell a little bit about the Swedish story about that. Because while the activism in favour of banning smacking is considerable, and there's my old schoolmate and housemate, Giles Corran, wrote a very touching article in the Times a few days ago about how his father, the famous comedian Alan Corran, had been smacking him or hit him quite hard from the age of 8 until the age of 18, which is the time I knew him. I always thought he was very sensitive and aggro kind of chap. And of course, if you Google the benefits and the disadvantages of smacking, the first couple of Google pages turn up with a science showing that it's abusive and terrible. Yes, but I just want to, we're a contrarian channel here, and I just want to cite something. There's a difference between child abuse and modest smacking, and there's a Swedish psychiatrist doctor who's very well known in Sweden, who's picked up the Swedish evidence and argues that, his name is David Eberhard, and we'll try and have him on later this week. And he says that the reason why Swedish schools are out of control and Swedish kids are so rude and undisciplined is the complete absence of any kind of physical punishment. And he thinks that the Swedish children become spoiled and entitled. And this famous PISA study of children's academic results, which goes up to the age of 15, I think, shows that Sweden does moderately well on many scores, but it's worst of all the OECD countries when it comes to turning up on time for school classes and a general doing of homework. So some people might think that's a good thing, but also a bad thing. There's also If you could dig around and find it showing that moderate smacking, that is just a quick sort of dash at the bottom, is actually leads to better outcomes. And there's a University of Otago in New Zealand has that. And this the lady who wrote this paper, and citing many other papers, psychologist Jane Millichamp says to the New Zealand Herald a few years ago, preliminary analysis shows that those who were merely smacked had similar or even slightly better outcomes than those who were not smacked in terms of aggression, substance abuse, adult convictions, and school achievement. Study members in the smacking-only category of punishment appear to be particularly highly functioning and achieving members of society, she says. I've looked at just about every study I can lay my hands on, and there are thousands, and I've not found any evidence that an occasional mild smack with an open hand on the cloth behind or the leg or hand is harmful and instills violence in kids. I know it's not a popular thing to say, but that is certainly the case. So we're always open to airing all opinions there. And I have to say, the very sort of consistent opinion against smacking comes from people quite ideological, and I can understand them. And we mustn't confuse it with child abuse, but let's have that debate, because I do think that it's quite possible that Labour might introduce something like that in the next parliament if they win, as they're expected to do. Meanwhile, back to more violent things or serious things with Basil Valentine, our political editor, after a very quick break. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk.
The facts, no spin or agenda.
Not enough with the lies, we need the facts.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We're going to go on to the day's news. But what did you think of that evidence for and against smacking? Any thoughts about that?
Well, the danger, of course, Pelle, and good afternoon to our viewers and listeners all around the world, is that it will mean children can snitch on their own parents and possibly even falsely accuse them. We all know that, you know, children are often resent their parents in pubescence and adolescence for one reason or another, justified or unjustified. An awful lot of broken homes these days. You know, not many children have both parents living with them right the way through to adulthood. And therefore, there's the opportunity to accuse a stepfather, a stepmother, or any unpopular relative of smacking when it hasn't happened at all. And, you know, it's a dreadful thing. But as for the actual merits or demerits of it, well, all I can say is I was the recipient of mild corporal punishment in my youth, and it certainly hasn't made me a violent individual, and really didn't leave any permanent scars as far as I'm aware. I mean, I think there's a line, isn't there, in the sand, depending on the sort of frequency and intensity of corporal punishment and the age at which it's administered as well, because I think very young children can't understand anything other than unconditional love coming from their parents. But then you reach a certain age where you begin to develop some sense of morality of what's right or wrong, and that if you've done something very obviously wrong or stupid, you are corrected for it, you know. So,
yeah. So you have a moderate view, and so do I. And there's an anti-smacking ban website that talks about the horrific possibilities of someone coming in from the social services. And we know Western countries, governments and social workers are becoming increasingly intrusive on our private lives. You know, there's that law, isn't there a law in Scotland now that you can be prosecuted for saying racist things in your own home, which is another, you know, recipe for children snitching. And this, as you said, it can give up that possibility. But and so smacking should be quite mild and it to be effective, and it's already the serious smacking, serious corporal punishment is already covered by current laws against child abuse, and we've got many social workers who worry about that and look after that. And as said, I mean, even the anti-smacking ban website thinks that it should only be carried out between, let's say, the ages of 5 and 10, and under quite strict conditions. And then it can be at least not harmful, but possibly even a little bit effective. Anyways, smacking, Netanyahu suffered from too little smacking in his youth, maybe?
Well, quite possibly. But for the time being, I just want to sort of stay on the social issues, which may be to the fore in the election of the new First Minister of Scotland, because Hamza Yousaf resigned a few hours ago, And one of the leading candidates is an opponent of Kate Forbes, is an opponent of the SNP's pro-trans policies. She's a member of the Socially Conservative Free Church of Scotland and does not support the Gender Recognition Reform Bill, which was particularly important to the Scottish Greens. She has also suggested that some of USAF's government's net zero policies are too ambitious. But according to Fergus Ewing, the Rural Economy and Tourism Secretary in the Scottish Government, she is without a shadow of a doubt head and shoulders above the other candidates and is also not associated with the problems that I think caused Humza eventually to resign. So it seems as though the SNP are going to soldier on as government. They will face a no-confidence motion from Labour at some point in the near future. It remains to be seen which way the Greens vote on that following the collapse of the Bute House agreement. But all the wheels are in motion there north of the border for an imminent change of government, just as they are in the UK as well. Speculation.
I'm standing up for the Europeans who don't follow British politics that closely. Humza, what did he do wrong and what is the Bute House agreement?
Well, the Bute House agreement was a coalition agreement between the Scottish National Party and the Green Party for a power sharing arrangement that gave the Greens a seat in government in the United Kingdom for the first time ever, which was quite extraordinary. But through various things, council tax charges, net zero policies, rewilding, things like this, they've gradually drifted apart. And as a result, Yusuf has been made to carry the can. He was only First Minister for just over a year. He told Sky News, "I've been somewhat overwhelmed by the requests that have been made for me to take over." That's John Swinney, who's also a leading candidate for First Minister.
So he dragged the party to the left and the public didn't like that and he had to go, basically.
Slightly simple way of putting it. I mean, I don't think Yusuf was universally popular amongst the SNP's core base constituency, and the numbers, of course, always make a difference, and the SNP's support has collapsed in recent months. Worth remembering too that the husband of former First Minister Nicola Sturgeon was arrested for embezzling party funds. So turmoil all round, really.
Right. Well, he has made a kind of figure for himself in the world media, I'd say, somebody who's doesn't look particularly Scottish and doesn't behave according to Scotland's Enlightenment principles of free speech, as he'll be forever associated with the crackdowns on free speech with all this trans bill. So I guess he's a vote loser for many middle of the road Scots. And I guess the SNP can see that and dumped him in favour of somebody who's more moderate, is what you're saying.
Yes. I mean, I think he just personally lost the support of his colleagues for one reason or another. Ultimately, it was the Greens walking away that means he could no longer carry on in a majority government. It is worth giving him a little bit of support for being the only First Minister from any part of the United Kingdom to call for a ceasefire in Gaza, because his wife's family were there at the outbreak of the recent hostilities. So he has at least got that feather in his cap.
He was dragged in two directions. The Greens didn't think he was left enough, and his the majority of support thought he was too left, maybe.
Yes, anyway. He said he wasn't willing. When he resigned, he said he wasn't willing to trade his principles just to win a no confidence vote. He said he had hoped to continue working with the Scottish Greens in a more informal way, but he underestimated how much hurt his decisions have caused. He says, while a route to winning in the no-confidence motion was possible, he was not willing to compromise his principles, and that implies he was not willing to offer the ALBA party, the breakaway party headed by Alex Salmond, the concessions it was demanding in exchange for the support of Ash Regan.
Could you say what did happen to his family? Because I remember that was a few months ago, and that was in the headlines. And did they get out safely?
I think they did get out. I think they've got out. Otherwise,
I think we've got to go into our first interview there, but we'll carry on in the next hour, Basil, with more news and views. And thanks a lot. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. Back with our first guest after the break.
TNT's Alex Zaharoff-Royd.
One of the things that AI lets you accomplish in your business and personal life in a faster and more efficient way on your desktop than you could before, when you only had to do it through the cloud.
I think about what we do on a day-to-day basis, right? So as a salesperson, I'm creating emails to send out to customers to talk to them about how we'd love to do business with them, how we'd like to engage. And so one of the things that I've started to use is using AI to formulate, you know, emails and help start, instead of starting with a blank page. For me personally, I struggle with a blank page. I like to have something to build around. And so, you know, using a large language model has helped me be more efficient in my work life and create content and create things more quickly that I can then get out to market and work with my customers.
Talking Tech with Alex Zaharoff-Royd on today's News Talk, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's News Talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
I didn't ask to be thrown in the streets, but I did ask for help, and Covenant House was there for me.
For these kids who didn't ask to be put in this unthinkable situation, Covenant House is there. To learn more, go to safeplacetosleep.org today.
Mom was always very self-sufficient, but we started noticing things were off.
Alzheimer's. It was hard to hear that.
Early detection gave us time to seek information and support.
If you or your family are noticing changes, it could be Alzheimer's. Talk about seeing a doctor together.
On air 24/7. This is today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on this Monday afternoon. We're very pleased to have our friend Eric Krauss with us. Eric Krauss was a financier and a businessman in Moscow in the naughty noughties gangsterish 90s, and he made many contacts among the high flyers and the politicians active then. And he even knew Alexei Navalny, who the news tells us now, Wall Street Journal exclusive story, that the intelligence agencies and the American CIA and the Director of National Intelligence think that he was not killed by Putin. And I'd just like to say that a few months ago, obviously, the headlines were all about Putin's wickedness. Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, said that Navalny had been slowly murdered by President Putin and his regime, who fear nothing more than dissent from their own people. Well, now the CIA is saying that Navalny was not killed by Putin. What do you think of that, Eric?
Well, Putin also didn't start the Trojan War. He was not behind 9/11, and he didn't shoot Kennedy. It was so obvious from the beginning that there was no interest. Navalny was a figure well past his prime. He had been quite popular before the war in Ukraine, when he basically betrayed Russia by supporting the Ukrainians, by calling for further sanctions against Russia. His popularity plunged. I think he made a serious mistake in coming back to Russia. And he probably thought that the Americans could protect him in Moscow, which, of course, is a very silly mistake to make. But Putin was planning to swap him for a Russian agent held in Germany. And alive, Mr. Navalny was a valuable piece of property. Dead, he was worthless to anyone. So the notion that Putin, in the middle of this negotiation, would have killed Navalny is patently absurd. But then again, the Western press doesn't really ask too many questions when it's the anti-Russian narrative.
Mm. I wonder who did kill him, because Budanov, I think, who's head of military intelligence in Ukraine, said some time after, and he's very closely aligned with the Americans, he actually did die of a blood clot after the vaccine. But then there's this very suspicious arrival of his ex-wife, Mrs. Navalnaya, at the Munich Security Conference, escorted there by the British.
You'll find that these suspect deaths in Russia almost always occur at the time most damaging to the Russian government. Right before a big conference, right previously before Mr. Putin was going to give his speech in the West or something, this happened. There is no indication that a vaccine had anything to do with it. But Mr. Navalny was high strung. He was under serious pressure. He was in a very hard prison. He was seemingly in good health, and people do sometimes die of natural causes.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if he was killed. He could have been killed by his own allies, who would have found him more useful dead than alive. But that's just speculation. I really don't have access to the information.
Yeah, sure. And neither do I. It's just very, very, very suspect that Mrs. Navalnaya turned up at the Munich Security Conference with all these defense ministers and intelligence officials and cried these kind of crocodile tears, and then held out by the BBC in the evening broadcasts as the new face of Russian opposition, you know, almost as if this whole story had been pre-prepared for her transition to her to being the leading opposition figure, which of course she isn't, because no one's heard of her in Russia itself. But anyway.
No. She's not suited for the role. She has never been a public figure. And she has no particular charisma or political base in Russia. Plus, the time for pro-Western opposition in Russia is past. All the years that I lived there, from the 90s through this year, the last couple of years, there has always been what I call the Facebook generation, a very pro-Western, pro-American contingent in Moscow and St. Petersburg, and Mr. Navalny was head of that grouping. That has now disappeared, as Russia is in a state of war. And during times of war, people just don't necessarily flock to the opposition.
Mm. So I wonder why the Americans chose to leak this now, because TASS chose to emphasize the fact that America has told other countries' intelligence agencies, because My sort of bigger reading of this whole thing is that the Americans are more restrained than the British, and there might actually be some rivalry between MI6 and CIA, and the CIA is trying to rein in the British, and the British, MI6, are kind of taking risks and doing more provocations against the Russians, and the Americans are the more responsible power, if you like. And it all reminds me a little bit of the Suez Crisis, where the Americans actually supported Nasser and could work with him, but the British were intent on killing him. Have you got any thoughts about rivalry?
We've got to be careful when you talk about the Americans. The United States is a loose confederation of warring tribes. You have different factions which have their own agendas. And for an outsider, it's extremely difficult to understand who is doing what and what their agenda is. So certainly there are factions which would like to see an end to this war, because they've understood something, which is that the United States hegemony is not threatened by Russia, never has been. It is threatened by China. And pushing Russia into the open arms of China was insane. It was it went against hundreds of years of diplomatic practice, which was, you know, divide and conquer. Instead, they're unifying their enemies. And that's just a very foolish thing to do. And I think there are factions and certainly people around Mr. Trump who understand that and want to concentrate on their little war with China and not necessarily push Russia into the opposing camp.
Well, Eric, we're going to carry on talking about China after the break in about a minute's time. But I'll just give some background so you can launch straight into the issue. The Chinese, the Americans are trying to squeeze the Chinese. And Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, was in Beijing last week and tried to get the Chinese to stop exporting economic components and dual-use stuff to the Russians. in an attempt to try and still starve Russia economically. Russia, meanwhile, of course, is doing very well exporting its oil because it's a land power, and it's building connections to Iran and building even some kind of transport route from Belarus all the way to Pakistan via Kyrgyzstan. So they're sort of proofing themselves from naval blockade. And of course, China and Russia have a land border. But we'll talk about that with Eric, who's an expert on this, I think, because he lives in Asia right now, after the news break, back in a minute or two. This is...
All right, let's get this underway for our first order of business.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylant here with your TNT headlines. Australia's Prime Minister has been accused of abusing his power after allegedly gaslighting a woman and making her cry at a national rally against domestic violence in the country's capital. There are renewed calls for the United Nations to lead an international investigation into the bombings of Russia's Nord Stream pipelines. And Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has been accused of lying to the public by downplaying the true extent of his country's military losses.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk. TNT Radio. TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on this Monday afternoon. We've got the brilliant Eric Krauss with us, who's an expert on Russia, but in recent years, I think he's lived in East Asia, and he focuses on the China-Russia relationship quite a lot. And China, of course, is being accused by the Americans of supplying the Russians with stuff they need to fight this war in Ukraine. What's going on there? Are the Americans going to try and starve the Russians of Chinese exports?
They would certainly love to do so. You will note that when Mr. Blinken left, his diplomatic send-off consisted of the U.S. ambassador. They didn't make him walk to the airport, but just about. So I think he got a very cold reception. American arrogance is grating on the Chinese. The Americans think, on the one hand, they can hector and sanction and do everything very publicly to weaken China, and that China will not fight back. China is now a larger economy than the U.S. is. It is much more industrialized. Its research, its technology is world class. And China is not going to be bullied. China is a rising power, and powers need allies. And the U.S. has, you know, to its credit, a very large contingent of client states or allies, depending on how you look at it. China is more limited, and Russia is vital to China. They have a huge land border. China has always looked east. It does not look west. West is where the barbarians came from. And now with a secure border with Russia and nothing to worry about on the west, China can focus on the east. Meanwhile, there is an obvious economic coalition between the two. China is great at manufacture. Russia has really good technology. It has really good research. Russians are really good at building prototypes. They are less good at manufacturing 100,000 of the next ones. So you can imagine that there can be quite a useful collaboration. Plus, Russia supplies pretty much everything China needs: foodstuffs, raw materials, energy, and it's uninterruptible. China is no doubt worried about a naval embargo and that the Americans could block the Singapore Straits or something in the event of a war over Taiwan. Well, the border with Russia cannot be blocked. So it is of great value to the Chinese, and they're aware of this.
Yeah, but what do you think the American strategy is? I mean, that Blinken visit was interesting because on the one hand, they talk, both the Americans and the Chinese say beautiful things to each other, and we all feel relieved when they say that we're going to make friends again. But then you have immediately after, you have a Blinken saying threatening things in his press conference once he's back in the States. And then there was this little YouTube type clip that Xi or his minions released, where Xi was walking around in a room waiting for Blinken to turn up because Blinken was apparently late, and said, looking at his watch, and said, "When is this man leaving?" in an exasperated tone. And obviously that was leaked and released to put down Blinken. So, you know, where is that relationship heading? I mean, are they friends? Are they going to try and seek friendship?
American diplomacy has unfortunately reached rock bottom. They are mostly playing to a domestic audience. So on the one hand, they will talk about the importance of preserving the relationship. And the other hand, then they just have to go out. It's like, you know, Biden's idiocy about calling, you know, Xi a dictator. Whether he thinks it or not doesn't matter. The point is that if you're trying to find common language with someone, if you're trying to negotiate, you don't start by insulting them. You don't start by threatening the Chinese. They don't like it. They don't like Western arrogance. They were subjected to it for far too long. And it just doesn't seem that there is any overweening master plan, that they've really thought through what they're trying to attain besides a few electoral votes. So I don't really see any particular strategy. On the one hand, they want China to be compliant. On the other hand, they want to, and they make it very publicly clear, they want to stunt Chinese growth in technology, in economics. So it's just they want two different things at the same time, and they're likely to get neither.
Mm. One thing you talked about before in our pre-interview, as it were, you were saying that the one area where China is vulnerable is its banking system. And the Americans have started to sanction some Chinese banks. How does that work, and how could the Chinese get around that?
This is the weaponization of the dollar. I mean, I think we all agree that it's got a shelf life, and the shelf life isn't particularly long, but at present, it's still there. It works. Most banks need access to dollar finance, to dollar funding, to dollar settlement, and the U.S. can cut them off very easily by denying them correspondent banking privileges. And this, for a big bank, can be pretty much fatal. You notice when they did it to the French, how everyone had to capitulate and pay huge fines to the U.S. Treasury. They're doing it with China. Now, I think the way China gets around this is the big four, the main Chinese banks, they're willing to comply. And then the Russian trade gets handled by regional banks, which don't do any dollar business anyway. So basically, China and Russia are now trading in yuan and rubles. And I believe only about 10% of their trade is still denominated in dollars. So to a great extent, they can get around, but it is a major inconvenience, especially for small Chinese exporters who don't have access to a lot of the banking system and have trouble getting paid for their sales to Russia. So it's definitely an inconvenience. It's not going to stop their collaboration by any means, but it is a stick in the spokes.
There was an interesting thing where the Chinese are saying, well, you know, why are we not allowed to export things to Russia when you and Americans are exporting things to supplying weapons to Ukraine?
Yeah.
What That's is obvious. The answer?
Yeah. The Americans consider they can send their weaponry and their soldiers wherever they want, but no one else is allowed to do so. The Chinese obviously feel differently. And it is very, very important to China to have an ally in the coming Cold War, and let's hope it stays cold, with the United States, because it's very clear that the U.S. is not going to is going to do whatever it can to prevent anybody from challenging its hegemony. And China intends to challenge that hegemony. The crazy thing was that Russia, 10 years ago, was very much pro-Western. And it doesn't have the mass, it doesn't have the size to displace the U.S. So it's basically a conservative power looking for a good seat at the table and a bigger piece of the pie. China is a disruptive power. China is looking to change, to reinvent the global financial and political system, and pushing Russia into the Chinese camp was madness.
Well, it seems to me that some American analysts realize this, and at least, I mean, there does seem to be a move away from Ukraine among some people in the deep state in America. But of course, there are some people who are totally attached to it. And I guess there are a lot of sunk investments with Biden and so on. He feels he can't retreat from the war before the election because it's going to be yet another defeat after Afghanistan in 2021.
They have to keep Ukraine going for 2 days after the November election. It would look, there'd be mud all over their faces. And the problem with the Americans is, you know, you think there's some progress, and we did not think that the $60 billion for Ukraine or for the American defense industry was going to go through, and then it did. And how they pressured Johnson, I really don't know. But the deep state is powerful.
And it could, so that was an escalation of sorts, and so the next thing could be an escalation. Well, we don't know. Eric, thank you very much. Eric Krauss, financier and Russia and China expert. Love to have you on again. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on a Monday afternoon, and we'll be back after the break with our next guest. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks. Great to see you.
I was a quarterback at Hardaway High School, college first round draft pick, on and off the field. We were taught to not show any signs of weakness. During the football season, I would stop eating. But I didn't know I was depressed. I thought that something was wrong with me. For 20 plus years, was physical, physical, physical. We didn't have any education behind what mental health was. I started to learn it starts here first. If this is together, I'll be better as a father, as a man, and as a husband. Put the importance on your mental health. I'm not scared to talk about it anymore. The first tool is therapy. The second one is positive self-talk. And then journaling, putting your thoughts on paper. We have to redefine what being a strong man is and heal. Love your mind.
On a virtual road, you can test the limits of your driving ability to see how fast you can go under the most extreme conditions, like when it's dark, when the weather's bad, or when the unexpected happens. The higher the speed, the harder the impact. But driving isn't a game or a race. When you're on the road, just 10 miles per hour over the limit can mean the difference between life and death. You're responsible for people's lives and your own. Slow down and save lives.
Deconstructing PSYOPs, propaganda, and mainstream media garbage. Pelle Neroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on this Monday afternoon. We've got Ryan Christian with us, whose motto is question everything, come to your own conclusions. He's the founder and editor of The Last American Vagabond, which has a website of that name, and he's very active on Twitter. It's an excellent magazine. I checked it out. And one of the other slogans is a quote from John Lennon, living is easy with your eyes closed, misunderstanding all you see. So he's trying to wake us up, or wake up the populi from their mainstream dreams. Driven by a desire for accuracy, independent news stalwart Ryan Christian has a passion for the truth. He's won the Serena Shim Award for uncompromising integrity in journalism, and understands that Americans want their news to be transparent, devoid of opulence frothed out by today's corporate media. Well said. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
This idea that the border wall is, you know, the Trump fans are against any encroachments on their freedom. They're also very much in favor of the building this border wall. But you've got an interesting take on this, which I hadn't heard before. But I mean, obviously, a lot of people have had, in that the smart wall that Trump would like to build, and maybe is already being built by the Biden administration, is severely bad for our personal freedoms. Can you talk about that for a bit?
Yeah. And, you know, first and foremost, I'd love to shout out Whitney Webb's research on this, who is a writer for The Last American Vagabond, but also runs Unlimited Hangout.
She's brilliant. Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. And this is where a lot of that research comes from in general. And we've had a lot of kind of back and forth conversations. It's really alarming, first and foremost, before the wall itself, to kind of see how easy it is to specifically engineer and channel people in the two-party illusion, as I would frame it, into certain things that seemingly directly contradict what would a moment ago be something that you would never challenge. A previous example I've seen was from the same, and this is left and right, by the way, both sides are played this way. Right now it seems predominantly, and I see it kind of like a decades long kind of teeter totter of what side seems crazy or not, but that the right recently saw another example of this where, you know, Second Amendment shall not be infringed. You know, and I agree completely, except suddenly that became about trans people and whether they could hold guns. And suddenly there was an issue there. And you saw this immediate contradiction that there was no reason that somebody should be removed from their Second Amendment rights. Then suddenly it was up unless this is the person. So the same thing we're seeing today is that we're now in a position. And this started a while ago, as you rightly pointed out, even under Donald Trump, they already began the direction of the smart wall biometric tracking surveillance. Biden has continued this same point, and which again, two-party illusion, which obviously there was a big push for the border wall. And you can understand reasonings behind this about the idea of safety and immigration and so on. I have my own opinions, but that's not really what this is to get into. That there was a reason that they were wanting some kind of a physical barrier. There was an obvious two-party divide. The point was about having something that could actually stop people in regard to weaponized immigration, I argue, primarily. Then all of a sudden, Donald Trump changed this in a very alarming shift when it didn't seem to get a lot of attention from Republicans, where it became, we don't want an archaic wall. That's the term he used. And suddenly everything shifted into the idea of a smart wall. And right there should have been an immediate moment for Republicans to say, hold on, we're screaming about the Great Reset, which we all should be. We're talking about the COVID-19 illusion, the vaccine passports, the digital ID. And suddenly we just don't connect those dots, where I don't care if you think that it's for a different reason. It's the same conversation about biometric surveillance, tracking of your information and the loss of liberty in the exact same way. Now, we can go deeper, but go ahead if you have a question.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting because Republicans, it's very, you know, the deplorables or whatever, worry a lot about illegal immigration and legal immigration, you know. And this is, again, they're very aware of the whole digital passport or. And yet this is being smuggled in through a topic that they feel very strongly about or have a very fond opinion about. So in a way, they're going to be duped by it. And Trump seems to be in on it. But what would this smart wall consist? Can you kind of paint a picture of this, what it would look like in its various aspects? Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, look, it's not too hard to recognize. We can see what's going on in China in the same exact way, social credit, surveillance, biometric tracking, facial scans, fingerprints, iris scans. All this is exactly what we're talking about. Drones, surveillance from the sky. You know, this is the kind of stuff that which most Americans may not be aware is already on your doorstep. It's already on the cameras in your stoplights. I mean, this stuff is everywhere. I'm not to suggest that those are iris scans in your stoplights, but surveillance, broad surveillance that has now begun to step into that. And so this is now something that we need to connect to immediately what's happening in our lives. And what we're talking about on the border is a both way conversation. And this has been very public, right? That this is for Americans going out, Americans coming in, or legal immigrants going out, coming in, or illegal immigrants. And all of that's going to be tracking things that we should have a right to have a say in. And I want to point out that the idea of that is something that we don't fully understand what it will truly mean 50 years from now for them to have a complete biometric blueprint of what you are and what that may translate to in the future. We don't fully understand as Americans, but that's really what you will see. We're talking about checkpoints where you'll be scanning facial scans, iris scans, fingerprints, biometric, you know, heat signatures. I mean, all of this stuff. And this isn't my opinion. This is, you can read about the smart wall and what they're rolling out. Some people may not be concerned about that. I also have another side of this that I think is concerning, which is the idea of whether we're talking 5G or 6G and the health aspect of this. We've talked about the TSA. We've talked about what these things do, because that's actually a good way to think about it. That's a fraction of what we're going to be talking about on a border walls conversation, going through the different scans. These have health effects. They've acknowledged that. They just act like it's a small one-time thing. But what happens if you work across the border? What happens if you deal with this on the border? What happens if you work there? I mean, these things are going to have long-term effects. And that's just the beginning. The deeper picture of this is something that I really want to get into and open people's minds to.
Okay, but so some people have different views on immigration and legal, and people have different views on the privacy and control aspects. But how is it actually supposed to work? Does it actually work as designed? If you don't have a physical border, how do you stop people getting in? Do you photograph them and then catch them when they're well inside the United States, or what?
Well, that's a great point, actually. I think first and foremost, we have to acknowledge that the idea, I mean, I'm not going to suggest, I mean, in any circumstance, you're going to have people that are trying to break the law, people that try to skirt the laws and get through the border. That's always going to be a reality. Happens right now. And it happens a lot of times by design, in my opinion. My point is that that whole focus of why it's this building problem that, you know, with the migrant caravans, and it's largely engineered. And that got exposed just in Texas, where people went just down the line and there's gates swinging open. And it's like, well, hold on. Why are we focusing in this one point? So my point there is that I think that that is to drive us in certain directions. You're going to have the same issues, and a border wall built 10, you know, however high all the way down would definitely be a physical way to block people. The point would be that they already have infrastructure. They've got people there that are armed, that are doing the job that they claim sometimes isn't happening. So whether it's a smart wall or a wall blocking people, you're going to have people that try to get around it. It'll still be used to stop you from passing through. The difference is you're now going to have such intense, I mean, your question kind of cuts to the crux of this, which is it's not even about security, in my opinion. It's not about stopping illegal immigration. It's about full, active, constant surveillance of Americans. And of course, anybody else that may be a problem to the U.S. government. But that's how we have to view that. Is it's going to stop everything both ways, because and it's not because of the smart technology alone. It's because of what we already have. You're only adding the smart technology to the current system that stops people and stops free movement, you know, and that's how it'll work the same way with the addition of liberty removing tracking systems and biometric and everything we already discussed.
Well, it's very good of you to raise this topic, because whatever 10 weeks I've had this program, and it's never come up, but border walls have come up and liberty, and it's interesting to bring those two conversations together. But I guess to you were saying that you didn't complete your sentence, because, and it's kind of, I guess you said that you have border caravans, and then you've got a few kilometers down the road the border gates swinging open. Can you just expand that? Are you saying that the border does work, and it's just a sort of right-wing media trope that the people are flooding across the border? What is it?
Well, I think it comes down to what you mean by does it work. I mean, there's a whole wide range of what people think that's supposed to mean. And my point is, you're always going to have, I mean, there can be people that are working there that allow them to go through because they're bribed. There can be people that jump fences here and there. I mean, there's ways that this already happened, and it's always been the case. That's arguably why that's there, because you could argue there's a danger to people that might come through without interest in following the laws and so on. That's a basic reality. Now, I haven't, we can get into it, it's a deeper conversation about my opinions about the concept there. And I think that we have to recognize that a large reason for all of this is because of belligerent U.S. foreign policy. So there's a reason to be concerned, but there's also a reason to accept and acknowledge human rights and international law. But I think what's important to recognize is that we can see, knowing that there is some truth to the idea that there is an issue taking place, and I think that's political as well, one side choosing to ignore certain things or not, that there's also what on top of that real problem, lies and abuse around the issue. Like, there isn't anything else we deal with. To that point I was explaining, there are people that publicly discussed this and they went and showed the razor wire conversation, the big focus that was Texas for that moment, right? And they went down the road filming nonstop and showed you the next few checkpoints when there were literally gates that were open. In fact, some that didn't even have gates, they were taken off. And so the point is, how are we pointing over here and saying we're all going to die because of this one location and no one's doing their jobs when just down the road it's open? All that shows you, in my opinion, is that Texas is choosing to hype this one point for their own purposes, or the government, I would say. And some people are getting overly concerned about something that is in fact a problem, but more so a lie in that one moment. It's a nuanced situation. That's why we always have to understand.
So you're saying that barbed wire and the media focus on the Texas's focus on that, because are they saying to the rest of America, look, we are protecting the border, when in fact down the road the gates swing open, so they're not protecting the border in actual fact?
To a degree, yes. And this is the whole two-party illusion, because you've got, like, if the left was going to be pointing, or rather let's just say Trump's conservative side is going to be saying, look, it's Texas fighting for the border. How do you explain it? Just down the road, there's a door open. And the left would be highlighting that if they wanted to highlight that it was what they wanted, but nobody does that. So it's a larger two-party illusion.
So who is coming through this border then? I mean, we have the same thing in Europe, where our foreign policy in Libya and Syria has caused a lot of the problems, you know? So you invade the world, invite the world. And I've never understood the logic of that. It's like going to a wasp's nest and banging on it with a stick and then opening your window. I mean, you know, people come to Europe, and of course they're going to feel enormously resentful at what we've brought to their home countries, if nothing else, you know. But America's further away from these combat zones. So where do people really fly over, and who's organizing this?
Well, let's not forget South America has been a stomping ground for U.S. foreign policy for a very long time. And still to this very day, we don't focus on it as much. There's still starvation tactics in place in regard to Venezuela. There's still sanctions. And I mean, there's all sorts of dynamics. And yes, also from across the ocean. I mean, we could talk about any number of things, even from Libya. You know, we saw this translate over into Syria. You know, this happens the same way. It takes longer. Mm-hmm. But the point is that clearly there is an issue, even if it's by design, because let's just be clear about this. And this doesn't have to be a racism point. Like that's involved. But the idea is, even if you have, let's just say this, you're 100,000 Americans that are just coming into another state, that will cause issue. Just having a flood of people that suddenly need things in an area that's not set up to deal with that, that alone will cause issues. So that has to be considered. On top of that, you're having people that are coming in from a foreign country that are in desperate need, again, largely because of U.S. foreign policy destabilizing what they need. We love to throw it on them. They're seeking the American dream. No, they're just fleeing from our destroying of their world. But some of that maybe too. But the point is that there's a mix of that. And so we have to consider all of these things at the same time, not just one side or the other. But on top of that, I will actually give credence to the idea of weaponized migration. This is not a joke. This is a provable historical precedent dynamic that, I mean, we've seen this many times discussed. It's been proven. Right now, there's arguments being made that Israel's in fact doing that with the Palestinians. There's a whole conversation to be had. And so that's part of it too. So we have to acknowledge all these things, and that's what the nuance is about, because I can promise you that there's somebody out there who is trying to take advantage of these caravans. In fact, the caravan itself might be orchestrated for that reason, but there's also average people to use that to manipulate, to get somebody through the border for certain reasons. But I also argue that you wouldn't necessarily need that today. There's a lot of other things you could manipulate within the country, but I'll point out, and then I'll end this point, that it's already been caught that there was a person that was highlighted on video saying that, "You don't know who I am, but you're going to find out soon." It got a lot of attention. He was going through the border and they made the point to say, "Oh, this is a guy who's threatening something as a terrorist. That's why I have to be concerned." Turns out, first, the Republicans highlighted it and said, "He's an Azerbaijani terrorist." It turned out, with very small research, that he wasn't. He was actually from Egypt. He was Jordanian, and he was previously arrested for recruiting from Assad. It's a provable reality. And I talked about this on my show. And then weirdly enough, they all stopped talking about it. And so I find that it's interesting to worry about even our allies, the government's allies, utilizing this for things that we may be seeing manufactured. Now, I'll leave it there.
So you think you'd, okay, so I'll just summarize, and you didn't have to refuse it. But so Mossad, America's ally, is kind of weaponizing immigration to change the demographics of the United States, or just cause problems. I'll just say one thing. I think that settlement, migration, colonization, invasion are all different words for maybe the same thing or a similar thing, and we ought to be having that conversation more honestly, because Sweden has basically been invaded, you know, I mean, by mothers with the broods of 3 or 4 or 5 children, not by special forces holding machine guns as in Ukraine. But I mean, you know, one thing you're supposed to welcome, the other thing you're supposed to oppose with all your resources. And I think that's a false distinction. I think we ought to have a much more open conversation about that. But just
yes, so can I comment on that really quickly?
Yeah, sure.
Sorry, I just think that's really important, because I would argue still that if we're talking about Sweden in particular, 100%, you can, it's impossible to deny the fact that there has been an effort to manipulate the demographic there. But that doesn't mean that everybody involved is a terrorist, or everybody involved there is somehow guilty of something, right? And I know that's not the point you were making. I'm saying for a lot of people in the world would try to then, in the partisan world, make it out they're either illegals or they're something else. And there's people caught in the middle that are just being used. So we need to make sure we're clear about that, you know? So go ahead.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, people talk about the increased crime rate in Sweden, but it's actually it's 40 people extra dying per year, which is not a lot, you know? So a lot of the alarmist headlines that you see got to be taken into proportion. And it's very hard to get these things right when you're talking about issues like immigration. I've tried to be very moderate about it. I'm afraid we've only got a minute left. So Ryan, just to be clear, you oppose a smart wall because of the privacy constraints. What should we do so you believe in a physical wall properly controlled and administered? Is that what you're saying? Not at all.
Necessarily. No. Okay. I mean, no, I agree in acknowledging and enforcing the laws we currently have. I mean, it's as simple as that. And anybody honest is going to realize that there will always be this. I mean, look, if you want to put up a border wall and make sense of it and not apply it in illegal ways or use it to, I mean, the point is I can see the logic of that. So I'm not going to say wrong on the wall, but I will argue that it shouldn't be the kind of way that it's being pushed from the extreme sides. I think we need to acknowledge human rights, our foreign policy, and not violate our liberties.
Right. Well, that's very good. We ought to have a holistic discussion about this and get away from pie throwing and extremist rhetoric.
Exactly.
And be open minded, and I think I think we agree on this fundamentally. And I'd love to discuss this with you further, because war and immigration are two of the hot issues at the moment. So Ryan, Christian, thank you very much. The Last American Vagabond. Check out the website. Check him out on Twitter. And we will continue this discussion. Thank you very much. This is the Pelinero Taylor Show on TNT on this Monday afternoon. Thank you.